The fact that Manson directed even the sex lives of his followers was powerful evidence of his domination. I asked Watkins for other examples specifically involving co-defendants. He recalled that once, at Spawn Ranch, Charlie told Sadie, "I'd like half a coconut, even if you have to go to Rio de Janeiro to get it." Sadie got right up and was on her way out the door when Charlie said, "Never mind." It was a test. It was also, by inference, evidence that Susan Atkins would do anything Charles Manson asked her to do. As with the others, I questioned Watkins about Manson's programming techniques. He told me something very interesting, which apparently the other family members didn't know. He said that when Manson passed out the LSD, he always took a smaller dose than the others. Though Manson never told him why he did so, Paul presumed that during the trip, Manson wanted to retain control over his own mental faculties. It is said that LSD is a mind-altering drug which tends to make the person ingesting it a little more vulnerable and susceptible to the influence of third parties. Manson used LSD trips, Paul said, to instill his philosophies, exploit weaknesses and fears, and extract promises and agreements from his followers. As Manson's second-in-command, Watkins had enjoyed Charlie's confidence more than most of the others. I asked him if Manson had ever mentioned Scientology or the process. Watkins had never heard of the process, but Manson had told him that while he was in prison, he had studied Scientology, becoming a theta, which Manson defined as being clear. Watkins said that in the summer of 1968, he and Charlie had dropped into a church of Scientology in downtown Los Angeles, and Manson asked the receptionist, "What do you do after clear?" When she was unable to tell him anything he hadn't already done, Manson walked out. One aspect of Manson's philosophy especially puzzled me, his strange attitude toward fear. He not only preached that fear was beautiful, he often told the family that they should live in a constant state of fear. What did he mean by that? I asked Paul. To Charlie, fear was the same thing as awareness, Watkins said. The more fear you have, the more awareness, hence the more love. When you're really afraid, you come to now. And when you are at now, you are totally conscious. Manson claimed that children were more aware than adults, because they were naturally afraid. But animals were even more aware than people, he said, because they always lived at now. The coyote was the most aware creature there was, Manson maintained, because he was completely paranoid. Being frightened of everything, he missed nothing. Charlie was always selling fear, Watkins continued. He wanted people to be afraid, and the more afraid, the better. Using this same logic, Charlie said that death was beautiful, because people feared death. I would learn from talking to other family members that Manson would seek out each individual's greatest fear, not so the person could confront and eliminate it, but so he could re-emphasize it. It was like a magic button which he could push at will to control that person. "Whatever you do," Watkins advised me, as had both Crockett and Poston, "don't ever let Charlie know you were afraid of him." One day at Spawn, without warning or provocation, Manson had jumped on Watkins and started strangling him. At first, Paul resisted, but then, gasping for breath, he suddenly gave up, stopped resisting. "It was really weird," Watkins said. "The instant I stopped fearing him, his hands flew off my throat, and he jumped back as if he'd been attacked by an unseen force." "Then it's like the barking dog," I commented. "If you show fear, it will attack. If you don't, it won't." "Exactly. Fear turns Charlie on." Paul Watkins was inherently more independent than Brooks Poston, much less the follower type. Yet he too had remained with the family for a long period. Other than the girls, was there some reason why he stayed? "I thought Charlie was Christ," he told me, not blinking an eye. Both Watkins and Poston had severed the umbilical linking them to Manson. but both admitted to me that they still weren't completely free of him, that even now they would sometimes lapse back into a state where they could feel Manson's vibrations. It was Paul Watkins who finally supplied the missing link in Manson's motive for the murders. Yet if I hadn't talked to Jacobson and Poston, I might have missed its importance, for it was from all three, Greg, Brooks, and Paul, that I obtained the keys to understanding, 1, Charles Manson's unique interpretation of the Book of Revelation, and 2, his decidedly curious and complex attitude toward the English musical group, The Beatles. Several persons had told me Manson was fond of quoting from the Bible, particularly the 9th chapter of Revelation. Once Charlie had handed Jacobson a Bible, already open to the chapter, and while he read it, supplied his own interpretation of the verses. With only one exception, which will be noted, what Greg told me tallied with what I later heard from Poston and Watkins. The four angels were the Beatles, whom Manson considered leaders, spokesmen, prophets, according to Greg. The line, "And he opened the bottomless pit, and there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power," was still another reference to the English group, Greg said. Locusts, beetles, one and the same. Their faces were as the faces of men, yet they had hair as the hair of women. An obvious reference to the long-haired musicians. Out of the mouths of the four angels issued fire and brimstone. Greg, this referred to the spoken words, the lyrics of the Beatles' songs, the power that came out of their mouths. Their breastplates of fire, Poston added, were their electric guitars. Their shapes, like unto horses prepared unto battle, were the dune buggies. The horsemen who numbered 200,000,000 and who would roam the earth spreading destruction were the motorcyclists. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. I wondered about that seal on the forehead. How did Manson interpret that? I asked Jacobson. It was all subjective, Greg replied. He said there would be a mark on people. Charlie had never told him exactly what the mark would be, only that he, Charlie, would be able to tell. He would know, and that the mark would designate whether they were with him or against him. With Charlie, it was either one or the other, Greg said. There was no middle road. One verse spoke of worshipping demons and idols of gold and silver and bronze. Manson said that referred to the material worship of the establishment, of automobiles, houses, money. Question. Directing your attention to verse 15, which reads, "And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men." Did he say what that meant? Answer. He said that those were the people who would die in Helter Skelter. One third of mankind. The white race. I now knew I was on the right track. Only on one point did Jacobson's recollection of Manson's interpretation differ from that of the others. The first verse of Revelation 9 refers to a fifth angel. The chapter ends, however, referring to only four. Originally, there were five Beatles, Greg explained, one of whom, Stuart Sutcliffe, had died in Germany in 1962. Poston and Watkins, who unlike Jacobson were members of the family, interpreted this much differently. Verse 1 reads, "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit." To members of the family, the identity of that fifth angel, the ruler of the bottomless pit, was never in doubt. It was Charlie. Verse 11 reads, "And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon." The king also had a Latin name, which, though it appears in the Catholic Douay version, was inadvertently omitted by the translators of the King James version. It was Exterminans. Exterminans. True name, Charles Manson. As far as Jacobson, Watkins, and Poston knew, Manson placed no special meaning on the last verse of Revelation 9, but I found myself thinking of it often in the months ahead. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. The important thing to remember about Revelation 9, Greg told me, is that Charlie believed this was happening now, not in the future. It's going to begin now, and it's time to choose sides. Either that, or flee with him to the desert. According to Jacobson, Manson believed the Beatles were spokesmen. They were speaking to Charlie through their songs, letting him know from across the ocean that this is what was going to go down. He believed this firmly. He considered their songs prophecy, especially the songs in the so-called White Album. He told me that many, many times. Watkins and Poston also said that Manson and the family were convinced that the Beatles were speaking to Charlie through their music. For example, in the song I Will are the lines, "And when at last I find you, your song will fill the air. Sing it loud so I can hear you. Make it easy to be near you." Charlie interpreted this to mean the Beatles wanted him to make an album, Poston and Watkins said. Charlie told them that the Beatles were looking for J.C., and he was the J.C. they were looking for. He also told them that the Beatles knew that Christ had returned to Earth again and that he was living somewhere in Los Angeles. "How in the world did he come up with that?" I asked them. In the White Album is a song called Honey Pie, a lyric of which reads, "Oh, honey pie, my position is tragic. Come and show me the magic of your Hollywood song." A later lyric goes, "Oh, honey pie, you are driving me frantic. Sail across the Atlantic to be where you belong." Charlie, of course, wanted them to sail across the Atlantic to join him in Death Valley. While residing in the Gresham Street house, in January and February of 1969, just after the White Album was released, Manson and the girls sent several telegrams, wrote a number of letters, and made at least 3 telephone calls to England, attempting to reach the Beatles. No luck. The line, "I'm in love, but I'm lazy," from Honey Pie, meant to Charlie that the Beatles loved J.C., but were too lazy to go looking for him. Two, they'd just gone all the way to India, following a man who they'd finally decided was a false prophet, the Maharishi. They were also calling for J.C., Charlie, in the first 8 lines of the song Don't Pass Me By in Your Blues, and in the earlier Magical Mystery Tour album In Blue Jay Way. Much of this I would never use at the trial. It was simply too absurd. The Beatles' White Album, Manson told Watkins, Poston, and others, set up things for the revolution. His album, which was to follow, would, in Charlie's words, blow the cork off the bottle. That would start it. Much of the time at the Gresham Street house, according to Poston, Watkins, and others, was spent composing songs for Charlie's album. Each was to be a message song, directed to a particular group of people, such as the bikers, outlining the part they'd play in Helter Skelter. Charlie worked hard on these songs. They had to be very subtle, he said, like the Beatles' own songs, their true meaning hidden beneath the awareness of all but the tuned-in people. Manson was counting on Terry Melcher to produce this album. According to numerous family members, both Melcher and Jacobson denied this, Terry had promised to come and listen to the songs one evening. The girls cleaned the house, baked cookies, rolled joints. Melcher didn't show. Manson, according to Poston and Watkins, never forgave Terry for this. Melcher's word was no good, he said angrily on a number of occasions. Though the Beatles had made many records, it was the double-disc White Album, which Capitol issued in December 1968, that Manson considered most important. even the fact that the cover was white, with no other design except the embossed name of the group, held significance for him. It was, and remains, a startling album, containing some of the Beatles' finest music, and some of their strangest. Its 30 songs range from tender love ballads to pop parodies to cacophonies of noise made by taking loops of very diverse tapes and splicing them together. To Charles Manson, however, it was prophecy. At least, this is what he convinced his followers. That Charlie had renamed Susan Atkins Sadie Mae Glutz long before the White Album appeared, containing the song Sexy Sadie, was additional proof to the family that Manson and the Beatles were mentally attuned. Almost every song in the album had a hidden meaning, which Manson interpreted for his followers. To Charlie, Rocky Raccoon meant coon or the black man, while to everyone except Manson and the family it was obvious that the lyrics of Happiness is a Warm Gun had sexual connotations, Charlie interpreted the song to mean that the Beatles were telling Blackie to get guns and fight Whitey. According to Poston and Watkins, the family played 5 songs in the White Album more than all the others. They were Blackbird, Piggies, Revolution 1, Revolution 9, and Helter Skelter. Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life you were only waiting for this moment to arise, went the lyrics of Blackbird. According to Jacobson, Charlie believed that the moment was now and that the black man was going to arise, overthrow the white man and take his turn. According to Watkins, in this song Charlie figured the Beatles were programming the black people to get it up, get it on, start doing it. On first hearing the song, I'd thought that the LaBianca Killers had made a mistake, writing Rise instead of Arise. However, Jacobson told me that Charlie said the black man was going to rise up against the white man. Rise was one of Charlie's big words, Greg said, providing me with the origin of still another of the key words. Both the Tate and LaBianca murders had occurred in the dead of night. However, if the parallel had special significance to Manson, he never admitted it to anyone I interviewed, nor, if he knew it, did he admit the dictionary meaning of the phrase Helter Skelter. The song Helter Skelter begins, "When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide, where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride." According to Poston, Manson said this was a reference to the family emerging from the bottomless pit. There was a simpler explanation. In England, home of the Beatles, Helter Skelter is another name for a slide in an amusement park. If you listen closely, you can hear grunts and oinks in the background of the song Piggies. Unlike ex-Beatles John Lennon and Paul McCartney, George Harrison refused the author's permission to quote from the lyrics of any of his songs, including Piggies. By Piggies, Greg and the others told me, Manson meant anyone who belonged to the establishment. Like Manson himself, the song was openly critical of the Piggies, noting that what they really needed was a damned good whacking. By that he meant the black man was going to give the Piggies, the establishment, a damned good whacking, Jacobson explained. Charlie really loved that line, both Watkins and Poston said. He was always quoting it. I couldn't listen to the final stanza without visualizing what had happened at 3301 Waverly Drive. It describes Piggy couples dining out in all their starched finery, eating bacon with their forks and knives. Rosemary LaBianca, 41 knife wounds. Lino LaBianca, 12 knife wounds, punctured with a fork 7 times, a knife in his throat, a fork in his stomach, and on the wall in his own blood, death to pigs. There's a chord at the end of the song Piggies, Watkins said. It goes down, and it's a really weird chord. After the sound of Piggies snorting. And in the Revolution 9 song, there's that same chord, and after it they have a little pause and snort, snort, snort. But in the pause, there is machine gun fire. And it's the same thing with the Helter Skelter song. Paul continued. They had this really weird chord. And in the Revolution 9 song, there's the same chord again, with machine guns firing and people dying and screaming and stuff. The White Album contains two songs with the word Revolution in their titles. The printed lyrics of Revolution 1, as given on the jacket insert, read, "You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?" When you listen to the record itself, however, immediately after "out," you hear the word "in." Manson took this to mean the Beatles, once undecided, now favored the revolution. Manson made much of these hidden lyrics, which can be found in a number of the Beatles' songs, but are especially prevalent in the White Album. They were, he told his followers, direct communications to him, Charlie, J.C. Later on, the lyrics go, "You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we'd all love to see the plan." The meaning of this was obvious to Manson. Sing out, Charlie, and tell us how we can escape the Holocaust. Of all the Beatles' songs, Revolution 9 is easily the weirdest. Reviewers couldn't decide whether it was an exciting new direction for rock or an elaborate put-on. One critic said it reminded him of a bad acid trip. There are no lyrics as such, nor is it music in any conventional sense. Rather, it is a montage of noises, whispers, shouts, snatches of dialogue from the BBC, bits of classical music, mortars exploding, babies crying, church hymns, car horns, and football yells, which, together with the oft-reiterated refrain, "Number nine, number nine, number nine," build to a climax of machine gun fire and screams, to be followed by the soft and obviously symbolic lullaby, "Good night." Of all the songs in the White Album, Jacobson said, Charlie spoke mostly of Revolution 9. He said it was the Beatles' way of telling people what was going to happen. It was their way of making prophecy. It directly paralleled the Bible's Revelation 9. It was also the Battle of Armageddon, the coming black-white revolution portrayed in sound, Manson claimed, and after having listened to it myself, I could easily believe that if ever there were such a conflict, this was probably very much what it would sound like. According to Poston, when Charlie was listening to it, he heard in the background noise, in and around the machine gun fire and the oinking of pigs, a man's voice saying, "Rise." Listening to the recording again, I also heard it, twice repeated, the first time almost a whisper, the second a long, drawn-out scream. It is first heard 2 minutes and 34 seconds into the song, just after the crowd sounds that follow, lots of stab wounds, as it were, and informed him on the third night, and just before number nine, number nine. This was potent evidence. Through both Jacobson and Poston, I'd now linked Manson irrevocably with the word "rise" printed in blood at the LaBianca residence. In Revolution 1, the Beatles had finally decided to commit themselves to the revolution. In Revolution 9, they were telling the black man that now was the time to rise and start it all, according to Charlie. Manson found many other messages in this song, including the words, "Block that, Nixon." But as far as his philosophy of Helter Skelter was concerned, these were the most important. Charles Manson was already talking about an imminent black-white war when Greg Jacobson first met him in the spring of 1968. There was an underground expression current at the time, "the shit is coming down," variously interpreted as meaning the Day of Judgment was at hand or all hell was breaking loose, and Charlie often used it in reference to the coming racial conflict. But he wasn't rabid about it, Greg said. It was just one of many subjects they discussed. When I first met Charlie, in June 1968, he really didn't have any of this helter-skelter stuff going, Paul Watkins told me. He talked a little bit about the shit coming down, but just barely. He said when the shit comes down, the black man will be on one side and the white will be on the other, and that's all he said about it. Then, that December, Capitol issued the Beatles' White Album, one of the songs of which was Helter Skelter. The final stanza went, "Look out, helter skelter, helter skelter, helter skelter. Look out, background scream, helter skelter. She's coming down fast. Yes, she is. Yes, she is." Manson apparently first heard the White Album in Los Angeles while on a trip there from Barker Ranch, where most of the family remained. When Manson returned to Death Valley on December 31, 1968, he told the group, according to Poston, "Are you hep to what the Beatles are saying? Helter Skelter is coming down. The Beatles are telling it like it is." It was the same expression, except that in place of the word for defecation, Manson now substituted Helter Skelter. Another link had been made, this time to the bloody words on the refrigerator door at the La Bianca residence. Though this was the first time Manson used the phrase, it was not to be the last. Watkins, and he started rapping about this Beatle album and Helter Skelter and all these meanings that I didn't get out of it, and he builds this picture up and he called it Helter Skelter, and what it meant was the Negroes were going to come down and rip the cities all apart. After this, Watkins said, "We started listening to the Beatles' album constantly." Death Valley is very cold in the winter, so Manson found a two-story house at 20910 Gresham Street in Canoga Park, in the San Fernando Valley, not too far from Spawn Ranch. In January 1969, Watkins said, "We all moved into the Gresham Street house to get ready for Helter Skelter, so we could watch it coming down and see all of the things going on in the city." He, Charlie, called the Gresham Street house the Yellow Submarine from the Beatles movie. It was like a submarine in that when you were in it, you weren't allowed to go out. You could only peek out of the windows. We started designing dune buggies and motorcycles, and we were going to buy 25 Harley Sportsters. And we mapped escape routes to the desert, supply caches. We had all these different things going. I watched him building this big picture up, Paul noted. He would do it very slowly, very carefully. I swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. Before Helter Skelter came along, Watkins said with a sigh of wistful nostalgia, "All Charlie cared about was orgies." Before Jacobson and I had ever discussed the Beatles, I asked him, "Did Charlie ever talk to you about a black-white revolution?" Answer, "Yeah, that was Helter Skelter, and he believed it was going to happen in the near future, almost immediately." Question, what did he say about this black-white revolution? How would it come about, and what would it accomplish? Answer, it would begin with the black man going into white people's homes and ripping off the white people, physically destroying them, until there was open revolution in the streets, until they finally won and took over. Then black man would assume white man's karma. He would then be the establishment. Watkins, he used to explain how it would be so simple to start out. A couple of black people, some of the Spades from Watts, would come up into the Bel Air and Beverly Hills district, up in the Rich Piggy district, and just really wipe some people out, just cutting bodies up and smearing blood and writing things on the wall in blood. All kinds of super atrocious crimes that would really make the white man mad. Poston said very much the same thing before I ever talked to Watkins, but with the addition of one very important detail. He, Manson, said a group of real blacks would come out of the ghettos and do an atrocious crime in the richer sections of Los Angeles and other cities. They would do an atrocious murder with stabbing, killing, cutting bodies to pieces, smearing blood on the walls, riding pigs on the walls, in the victim's own blood. This was tremendously powerful evidence, linking Manson not only with the Tate murders, where pig had been printed in Sharon Tate's blood on the front door of the residence, but also with the LaBianca murders, where death to pigs had been printed in Lino LaBianca's blood on the living room wall. and I questioned Poston in depth as to Manson's exact words, where the conversation had occurred, when, and who else was present. I then questioned everyone Poston mentioned who was willing to cooperate. Ordinarily, I try to avoid repetitious testimony in a trial, knowing it can antagonize the jury. However, Manson's helter-skelter motive was so bizarre that I knew if it was expounded by only one witness, no juror would ever believe it. The conversation had occurred in February 1969 at the Gresham Street house, Poston said. We now had evidence that 6 months before the Tate-LaBianca murders, Charles Manson was telling the family exactly how the murders would occur, complete even to writing pigs in the victim's own blood. We now had also linked Manson with every one of the bloody words found at both the Tate and LaBianca residences. But this would only be the beginning, Manson told Watkins. These murders would cause mass paranoia among the whites. Out of their fear, they would go into the ghetto and just start shooting black people like crazy. But all they would kill would be the ones that were with Whitey in the first place. The true black race, whom Manson identified at various times as the Black Muslims and the Black Panthers, wouldn't even be affected by it. They would be in hiding, waiting, he said. After the slaughter, the Black Muslims would come out and appeal to the whites, saying, "Look what you have done to my people." And this would split Whitey down the middle, Watkins said, between the hippie liberals and all the uptight conservatives. And it would be like the war between the states, brother against brother, white killing white. Then after the whites had mostly killed off each other, the black Muslims would come out of hiding and wipe them all out. All except Charlie and the family, who would have taken refuge in the bottomless pit in Death Valley. The karma would then have turned. Blackie would be on top. And he would begin to clean up the mess, just like he always has done. He will clean up the mess that the white man made and build the world back up a little bit, build the cities back up. But then he wouldn't know what to do with it. He couldn't handle it. According to Manson, Watkins said, the black man had a problem. He could only do what the white man had taught him to do. He wouldn't be able to run the world without Whitey showing him how. Watkins. Blackie then would come to Charlie and say, you know, I did my thing. I killed them all, and, you know, I am tired of killing now. It is all over. And then Charlie would scratch Blackie's fuzzy head and kick him in the butt and tell him to go pick cotton and go be a good nigger, and we would live happily ever after. The family, now grown to 144,000, as predicted in the Bible, a pure, white, master race would emerge from the bottomless pit, and it would be our world then. There would be no one else, except for us and the black servants. And according to the Gospel of Charlie, as he related it to his disciple Paul Watkins, he, Charles Willis Manson, the fifth angel, J.C., would then rule that world. Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, and Greg Jacobson had not only defined Manson's motive, helter-skelter, Watkins had supplied that missing link. In his sick, twisted, disordered mind, Charles Manson believed that he would be the ultimate beneficiary of the black-white war and the murders which triggered it. One day at the Gresham Street house, while they were on an acid trip, Manson had reiterated to Watkins and the others that Blackie had no smart, that the only thing Blackie knows is what Whitey has told him or shown him, and so someone is going to have to show him how to do it. I asked Watkins, how to do what? Answer, how to bring down Helter Skelter. How to do all these things. Watkins. Charlie said the only reason it hadn't come down already was because Whitey was feeding his young daughters to the black man in Haight-Ashbury, and he said that if his music came out and all of the beautiful people, love, he called it, left Haight-Ashbury, Blackie would turn to Bel Air to get his rocks off. Blackie had been temporarily pacified by the young white girls, Manson claimed. But when he took away the pacifier, when his album came out and all the young loves followed Pied Piper Charlie to the desert, Blackie would need another means of getting his frustrations out, and he would then turn to the establishment. But Terry Melcher didn't come through. The album wasn't made. Sometime in late February of 1969, Manson sent Brooks and Juanita to Barker Ranch. The rest of the family moved back to Spawn and began preparing for Helter Skelter. Now there was an actual physical effort to get things together so they could move to the desert, Greg said. Jacobson, who visited the ranch during this period, was startled at the change in Manson. Previously, he had preached oneness of the family, complete in itself, self-sufficient. Now he was cultivating outsiders, the motorcycle gangs. Before this, he had been anti-materialistic. Now he was accumulating vehicles, guns, money. It struck me that all this contradicted what Charlie had done and talked to me about before, Greg said, explaining that this was the beginning of his disenchantment and eventual break with Manson. The newly materialistic Manson came up with some wild money-making schemes. For example, someone suggested that the girls in the family could earn $300 to $500 a week apiece working as topless dancers. Manson liked the idea. With 10 broads pulling in $3,000 a week and upward, he could buy jeeps, dune buggies, even machine guns, and he sent Bobby Beausoleil and Bill Vance to the Girard Agency on the Sunset Strip to negotiate the deal. There was only one problem. With all his powers, Manson was unable to transform molehills into mountains. With the exception of Sadie and a few others, Charlie's girls simply did not have impressive busts. For some reason, Manson seemed to attract mostly flat-chested girls. While at the Gresham Street house, Manson had told Watkins that the atrocious murders would occur that summer. It was almost summer now, and the blacks were showing no signs of rising up to fulfill their karma. One day in late May or early June of 1969, Manson took Watkins aside, down near the old trailer at Spawn, and confided, "The only thing Blackie knows is what Whitey has told him." He then added, "I'm going to have to show him how to do it." According to Watkins, "I got some weird pictures from that." A few days later, Watkins took off for Barker, fearful that if he stuck around, he would see those weird pictures materialize into nihilistic reality. It was September of 1969 before Manson himself returned to Barker Ranch to find that Watkins and Poston had defected. Though Manson told Watkins about cutting Shorty into 9 pieces, he made no mention whatsoever of the Tate-LaBianca murders. In discussing Helter Skelter with Watkins, however, Manson said, without explanation, "I had to show Blackie how to do it." LAPD had interviewed Greg Jacobson in late November of 1969. When he attempted to tell them about Manson's far-out philosophy, one of the detectives replied, Charlie's a madman. We're not interested in all that." The following month, 2 detectives went to Shoshone and talked to Crockett and Poston. LAPD also contacted Watkins. All 3 were asked what they knew about the Tate-LaBianca murders, and all 3 said they didn't know anything, which in their minds was true, none having previously made the connection between Manson and these murders. After the interview with Poston and Crockett, one of the detectives remarked, "Looks like we made a trip for nothing." Initially, I found it difficult to believe that none of the 4 even suspected that Manson might be behind the Tate-LaBianca murders. There were, I discovered, several probable reasons for this. When Manson had told Jacobson how Helter Skelter would start, he had said nothing about writing words in blood. He had told this to both Watkins and Poston, even telling Poston about the word pigs, but there were no newspapers at Barker Ranch, and its location was such that there was no radio reception. Though they had heard about the murders on their infrequent supply trips into Independence and Shoshone, both stated they hadn't picked up many details. The main reason, however, was simply a fluke. Though the press did report that there was bloody writing at the LaBianca residence, LAPD had succeeded in keeping one fact secret. That two of the words were Helter Skelter. Had this been publicized, undoubtedly Jacobson, Watkins, Poston, and numerous others would have connected the LaBianca murders, and probably the Tate murders also because of their proximity in time with Manson's insane plan. And it seems a safe assumption that at least one would have communicated his suspicions to the police. It was one of those odd happenstances for which no one was at fault, the repercussions of which no one could foresee, but it appears possible that had this happened, the killers might have been apprehended days rather than months after the murders, and Donald, Shorty Shea, and possibly others, might still be alive. Though I was now convinced we had the motive, other leads failed to pan out. None of the employees at the Standard Station in Sylmar or the Jack Frost store in Santa Monica could identify anyone in our family album. As for the LaBianca credit cards, all appeared to be accounted for, while Suzanne Struthers was unable to determine if a brown purse was missing from her mother's personal effects. The problem was that Rosemary had several brown purses. By the time LAPD requested the Spahn Ranch phone records, most of the billings for May and July 1969 had been lost or destroyed. All the numbers for the other months, April to October 1969, were identified, and though we obtained some minor background information on the activities of the family, we were unable to find any link between the killers and the victims. Nor did any appear in the phone records of the Tate and LaBianca residences. Exposure to rain and sunlight over a prolonged period of time breaks down human blood components. Many of the spots on the clothing the TV crew had found gave a positive benzidine reaction, indicating blood, but Granado was unable to determine whether it was animal or human. However, Granado did find human blood type B on the white T-shirt. Parent, Folger, and Frykowski were type B, and human blood, possible type O, on the dark velour turtleneck. Tate and Sebring were type O. He did not test for subtypes. He also removed some human hair from the clothing, which he determined had belonged to a woman, and which did not match that of the two female victims. I called Captain Carpenter at Sybil Brand and requested a sample of Susan Atkins' hair. On February 17th, Deputy Sheriff Helen Tabby took Susan to the jail beauty shop for a wash and set. Afterwards, she removed the hair from Susan's brush and comb. Later, a sample of Patricia Krenwinkel's hair was similarly obtained. Granado eliminated the Krenwinkel sample, but although he wasn't able to state positively that they were the same, he found the Atkins sample very, very similar to that taken from the clothing, concluding it was very likely the hair belonged to Susan Atkins. The points of similarity included color, diameter, length, as well as the medullary characteristics. Some white animal hairs were also found on the clothing. Winifred Chapman said they looked like the hair from Sharon's dog. Since the dog had died shortly after Sharon's death, no comparison could be made. I intended to introduce the hair into evidence anyway, and let Mrs. Chapman state what she had told me. On February 11th, Kitty Lutzinger had given birth to Bobby Beausoleil's child. Even before this, she was an unwilling witness, and the little information I got from her came hard. Later she would return to the family, leave it, go back. Unsure of what she might say on the stand, I eventually decided against calling her as a witness. I made the same decision in relation to biker Al Springer, though for different reasons. Most of his testimony would be repetitive of DiCarlo's. Also his most damning testimony, Manson's statement, "We got five of them the other night," was inadmissible because of Aranda. I did interview Springer several times, and one remark Manson made to him, re the murders, gave me a glimpse into Manson's possible defense strategy. In discussing the many criminal activities of the family, Manson had told Springer, "No matter what happens, the the girls will take the rap for it. I interviewed Danny numerous times, one session lasting 9 hours, obtaining considerable information that hadn't come out in previous interviews. Each time I picked up a few more examples of Manson's domination. Manson would tell the family when it was time to eat. He wouldn't permit anyone to be served until he was seated. During dinner, he would lecture on his philosophy. I asked Danny if anyone ever interrupted Manson while he was talking. He recalled that one time, a couple of broads started talking. Question: what happened? Answer: he threw a bowl of rice at them. Although DiCarlo was extremely reluctant to testify, Sergeant Gutierrez and I eventually persuaded him that it was in his own best interests to do so. I had less success with Dennis Wilson, singer and drummer for the Beach Boys. Though Wilson initially claimed to know nothing of importance, he finally agreed to level with me, but he refused to testify. It was obvious that Wilson was scared, and not without good reason. On December 4th, 1969, 3 days after LAPD announced they had broken the case, Wilson had received an anonymous death threat. It was, I learned, not the only such threat. The others were not anonymous. Though denying any knowledge of the family's criminal activities, Wilson did supply some interesting background information. In the late spring of 1968, Wilson had twice picked up the same pair of female hitchhikers while driving through Malibu. The second time he took the girls home with him. For Dennis, home was 14400 Sunset Boulevard, a palatial residence formerly owned by humorist Will Rogers. The girls, Ella Jo Bailey and Patricia Krenwinkel, stayed a couple of hours, Dennis said, mostly talking about this guy named Charlie. Wilson had a recording session that night and didn't get home until 3 a.m. When he pulled into the driveway, a strange man stepped out of his back door. Wilson, frightened, asked, "Are you going to hurt me?" The man said, "Do I look like I'm going to hurt you, brother?" He then dropped to his knees and kissed Wilson's feet, obviously one of Charlie's favorite routines. When Manson ushered Wilson into his own home, he discovered he had about a dozen uninvited houseguests, nearly all of them girls. They stayed for several months, during which time the group more than doubled in number. It was during Manson's Sunset Boulevard period that Charles Tex Watson, Brooks Poston, and Paul Watkins became associated with the family. The experience, Dennis later estimated, cost him about $100,000. Besides Manson's constantly hitting him for money, Clem demolished Wilson's uninsured $21,000 Mercedes-Benz by plowing it into a mountain on the approach to Spawn Ranch. The family appropriated Wilson's wardrobe and just about everything else in sight, and several times Wilson found it necessary to take the whole family to his Beverly Hills doctor for penicillin shots. It was probably the largest gonorrhea bill in history, Dennis admitted. Wilson even gave Manson 9 or 10 of the Beach Boys' gold records and paid to have Sadie's teeth fixed. The newly divorced Wilson obviously found something attractive about Manson's lifestyle. "Except for the expense," Dennis told me, "I got along very well with Charlie and the girls." "He and Charlie would sing and talk," Dennis said, "while the girls cleaned house, cooked, and catered to their needs." Wilson said he liked the spontaneity of Charlie's music, but added that Charlie never had a musical bone in his body. Despite this, Dennis tried hard to sell Manson to others. He rented a recording studio in Santa Monica and had Manson recorded. Though I was very interested in hearing the tapes, Wilson claimed that he had destroyed them because the vibrations connected with them don't belong on this earth. Wilson also introduced Manson to a number of people in or on the fringes of the entertainment industry, including Melcher, Jacobson, and Altobelli. At one party, Charlie gave Dean Martin's daughter, Deanna, a ring and asked her to join the family. Deanna told me she kept the ring, which she later gave to her husband, but declined Manson's invitation. As did the other Beach Boys, none of whom shared Dennis's fondness for the scruffy little guru, as one described him. Wilson denied having any conflicts with Manson during this period. However, in August 1968, 3 weeks before his lease was to expire, Dennis moved in with Greg, leaving to his manager the task of evicting Charlie and the girls. From Sunset Boulevard, the family moved to Spawn Ranch. Although Wilson apparently avoided the group for a time, he did see Manson occasionally. Dennis told me that he didn't have any trouble with Charlie until August 1969. Dennis could not recall the exact date, but he did know it was after the Tate murders, when Manson visited him, demanding $1,500 so he could go to the desert. When Wilson refused, Charlie told him, "Don't be surprised if you never see your kid again." Dennis had a 7-year-old son, and obviously this was one reason for his reluctance to testify. Manson also threatened Wilson himself, but Dennis did not learn of this until an interview I conducted with both Wilson and Jacobson. According to Jacobson, not long after Dennis refused Manson's request, Charlie handed Greg a .44 caliber bullet and told him, "Tell Dennis there are more where this came from." Knowing how the other threat had upset Dennis, Greg hadn't mentioned it to him. This incident had occurred in late August or early September of 1969. Jacobson was startled by the change in Manson. The electricity was almost pouring out of him. His hair was on end. His eyes were wild. The only thing I can compare it to is that he was just like an animal in a cage. It was possible there was still another threat, but this is strictly conjecture. In going through the Spawn Ranch phone bills, I found that on September 22, 1969, someone called Dennis Wilson's private number from the payphone at Spawn, and that the following day Wilson had the phone disconnected. Looking back on his involvement with the family, Dennis told me, "I'm the luckiest guy in the world, because I got off only losing my money." From rock star to motorcycle rider to ex-call girl, the witnesses in this case all had one thing in common. They were afraid for their lives. They needed only to pick up a newspaper or turn on TV to see that many of the family members were still roaming the streets, that Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem, was out on bail, while the Inyo County grand theft charges against Bruce Davis had been dismissed for lack of evidence. Neither Grogan, Davis, nor any of the others suspected of beheading Shorty Shea had been charged with that murder, there being as yet no physical proof that Shea was dead. Perhaps in her cell at Sybil Brand, Susan Atkins recalled the lyrics of the Beatles' song, "Sexy Sadie." "Sexy Sadie, what have you done? You made a fool of everyone. Sexy Sadie, you broke the rules. You laid it out for all to see. Sexy Sadie, you'll get yours yet, however big you think you are." Or perhaps it was simply that the numerous messages Manson was sending by other family members were getting to her. Susan called in Caballero and told him that under no circumstances would she testify at the trial, and she demanded to see Charlie. Caballero told Aaron and me that it looked as if we'd lost our star witness. We contacted Gary Fleischman, Linda Kasabian's attorney, and told him we were ready to talk. From the start, Fleischman, dedicated to the welfare of his client, had wanted nothing less than complete immunity for Linda Kasabian. Not until after I had talked to Linda myself did I learn that she had been willing to talk to us, immunity or not, and that only Fleischman had kept her from doing so. I also learned that she had decided to return to California voluntarily, against the advice of Fleischman, who had wanted her to fight extradition. After a number of discussions, our office agreed to petition the Superior Court for immunity after she had testified. In return, it was agreed, 1, that Linda Kasabian would give us a full and complete statement of her involvement in the Tate-LaBianca murders, 2, that Linda Kasabian would testify truthfully at all trial proceedings against all defendants, and 3, that in the event Linda Kasabian did not testify truthfully, or that she refused to testify for whatever reason, she would be prosecuted fully, but that any statement that she gave the prosecution would not be used against her. The agreement was signed by Younger, Levy, Bush, Stovitz, and myself on February 26, 1970. 2 days later, I interviewed Linda Kasabian. It was the first time she had discussed the Tate-LaBianca murders with anyone connected with law enforcement. As noted, given a choice between Susan and Linda, I'd preferred Linda, sight unseen. She hadn't killed anyone, and therefore would be far more acceptable to a jury than the bloodthirsty Susan. Now, talking to her in Captain Carpenter's office at Sybil Brand, I was especially pleased that things had turned out as they had. Small, with long light brown hair, Linda bore a distinct resemblance to the actress Mia Farrow. As I got to know her, I found Linda a quiet girl, docile, easily led, yet she communicated an inner sureness, almost a fatalism, that made her seem much older than her 20 years. The product of a broken home, she herself had had 2 unsuccessful marriages, the last of which, to a young hippie, Robert Kasabian, had broken up just before she went to Spawn Ranch. She had 1 child, a girl named Tanya, age 2, and was now 8 months pregnant with another, conceived, she thought, the last time she and her husband were together. She had remained with the family less than 1.5 months. I was like a little blind girl in the forest, and I took the first path that came to me. Only now, talking about what had happened, did she feel she was emerging from the darkness, she said. On her own since 16, Linda had wandered from East Coast to the West, looking for God. In her quest, she had lived in communes and crash pads, taken drugs, had sex with almost anyone who showed an interest. She described all this with a candor that at times shocked me, yet which I knew would be a plus on the witness stand. From the first interview, I believed her story, and I felt that a jury would also. There were no pauses in her answers, no evasions, no attempts to make herself appear something she was not. She was brutally frank. When a witness takes the stand and tells the truth, even though it is injurious to his own image, you know he can't be impeached. I knew that if Linda testified truthfully about those 2 nights of murder, it would be immaterial whether she had been promiscuous, taken dope, stolen. The question was, could the defense attack her credibility regarding the events of those 2 nights? And I knew the answer from our very first interview. They wouldn't be able to do so, because she was so obviously telling the truth. I talked to her from 1 to 4:30 p.m. on the 28th. It was the first of many long interviews, a half dozen of them lasting 6 to 9 hours, all of which took place at Sybil Brand, her attorney usually the only other person present. At the end of each interview, I'd tell her that if, back in her cell, anything occurred to her which we hadn't discussed, to jot it down. A number of these notes became letters to me, running to 12 or more pages, all of which, together with my interview notes, became available to the defense under discovery. The more times a witness tells his story, the more opportunities there are for discrepancies and contradictions, which the opposing side can then use for impeachment purposes. While some attorneys try to hold interviews and pre-trial statements to a minimum so as to avoid such problems, my attitude is the exact opposite. If a witness is lying, I want to know it before he ever takes the stand. In the more than 50 hours I spent interviewing Linda Kasabian, I found her, like any witness, unsure in some details, confused about others, but never once did I catch her even attempting to lie. Moreover, when she was unsure, she admitted it. Though she added many details, Linda Kasabian's story of those 2 nights was basically the same as Susan Atkins. There were only a few surprises, but they were big ones. Prior to my talking to Linda, we had assumed that she had probably witnessed only 1 murder, the shooting of Steve Parent. We now learned that she had also seen Katie chasing Abigail Folger across the lawn with an upraised knife, and Tex stabbing Wojtek Frykowski to death. She also told me that on the night the LaBiancas were killed, Manson had attempted to commit 3 other murders. Part 5. Don't you know who you're crucifying? For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, Behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Matthew chapter 24, verses 24-26. Just before we got busted in the desert, there was 12 of us apostles and Charlie. Family member, Ruth Ann Morehouse. I may have implied on several occasions to several different people that I may have been Jesus Christ,